Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, what does the new GOP healthcare bill mean for the Valley? We go beyond the politics to look for the real-world impacts and find out how the changes might actually work in real life. We'll also talk to Assemblymember Rudy Salas from Bakersfield and hear about his efforts to get more funding for Valley fever research. Plus, a new National Geographic documentary about California's water wars debuts tonight. We'll talk to the filmmaker. That, and it's time to get your gold pan and your sluice box out, because it turns out California's big wet winter means big things for local prospectors. We'll go in search of gold in Madera County with our own Ezra David Romero. We begin, though, with a look at a major trend in the local economy. For years, Kern County has been a big player in the world of logistics. That's a fancy word for the industry of warehouses and trucks that keep stores across the West stocked with the products we buy every day. Now, changes in the retail industry could strengthen the Valley's position in that space thanks to the internet. Ulta Beauty may be the biggest beauty product supplier in the country, but an announcement last week of their decision to open a distribution and fulfillment center in Fresno could be about much more than eyeliner and lipstick. Some experts think the Valley could develop into the hub that supplies on-demand products for the entire West Coast. But why? And are they good jobs? Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess takes a look.
In the bathroom of her central Fresno home, Ro Berunda looks through tote after tote filled with all manner of makeup.
Next one in is powders and contouring kits.
And Ro loves Ulta Beauty products. A literal card-carrying fan. She has an Ulta credit card.
And this is all from Ulta?
This is like 90% from Ulta.
She says she fell in love with the store and the makeup when a shop opened in Fresno, and now she only shops at Ulta.
It was like a candy store of makeup, you know, and you had so many different selections. You had everything from low-cost cosmetics to shampoos, nail polishes, a salon in the back, and then you have your higher-end cosmetics, and it was kind of like a one-stop shop for the makeup.
It's people like Ro that have economic development officials in the Valley giddy. The company, which is the largest beauty supplier in the country, recently announced that they would build a new distribution and internet fulfillment center in South Fresno. City of Fresno Economic Development Director Larry Westerland says these facilities aren't your dad's warehouse jobs with just a few men in a cavernous warehouse. These facilities have huge staffs.
With the internet fulfillment and what we're seeing with the automated fulfillment is there much higher numbers of people are required. They're much more efficient and they get out a lot more packages much more quickly, but higher numbers.
In the case of Ulta, they could use as many as 1,000 employees during their peak season. Westerland says Amazon is also considering building a fulfillment center right next door and could employ 2,000 people or more. That's because instead of one guy in a forklift moving boxes full of product, it's an army of workers seeking out a specific individual product. Salaries also routinely run ahead of the minimum wage. But Richard Chapman, with the Kern Economic Development Corporation, says because of the increasing reliance on technology in distribution and fulfillment centers, they are not simple or dead end, but highly technical careers.
Oh, they are. I mean, the old saying, you know, the old paradigm was that you would put boxes on a conveyor belt. Now you're programming the conveyor belt.
Kern County has up to 50 distribution centers headlined by big companies like IKEA and Target. Demand is so high that Chapman says Bakersfield College has established a bachelor degree in industrial automation. So the combination of upward mobility and solid salary makes distribution and fulfillment centers highly sought after by people like Chapman and Westerland. There are a number of reasons why the Central Valley is so attractive. The Valley has strong connections to transportation infrastructure like ports, highways, and railroads, and despite not being a major population center, is within reasonable range of LA, San Francisco, and even Portland and Seattle to capitalize on Amazon's model of low cost and fast delivery. Westerlund says another big key is the availability of land to build the massive structures.
You're talking about $125,000 an acre. In Southern California, in the Inland Empire, it's $550,000, $600,000 an acre. And when you're talking about 72 acres, that ends up adding pretty quickly.
The city of Fresno also offered tax incentives to draw Alta, but Westerlund says the incentives are only half the picture. Towns need to stay ahead of the curve, installing infrastructure like wide roads, sewers, and water to keep the economic momentum going. And that momentum could be the result of regional fragmentation of logistics, according to Donald Pettit, who helps companies scout locations for distribution and fulfillment centers. He echoes the reasons why the Central Valley is so attractive and says similar stories are playing out in other parts of the country, leading to a kind of regional hub-and-spoke distribution system.
We're seeing similar pieces in Pennsylvania. We're seeing similar pieces in Texas. And so there's a question of, are there regional hubs and what are the advantages of having them? And I think you can see that with air travel. Yes, there are definitely regional hubs. And there's definitely some, I guess, spillover effects for those hubs that make them a little bit more attractive.
Spillovers like attracting other companies and secondary economic activity in the local economy from the workers. And speaking of workers, Pettit also says because the Central Valley has a relatively high unemployment rate, there is a workforce in place ready to step up and take on the jobs the distribution and fulfillment centers provide. Alta expects to be operating by next summer. All our makeup aficionado Roe wants to know is, does that mean my makeup will get here faster? For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. All of the recent rain and snow in California is good news for farms and cities. In fact, the runoff flowing from the Sierra Nevada is so strong this year, it's moving huge boulders and tons of earth down our rivers. That also means gold is on the move. And as Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports, prospectors are on alert.
Larry Riggs and his friends are hunting on a piece of private property near Oakhurst. There are no guns or fishing poles present, just shovels, plastic bowls, and buckets. They're panning for gold.
There's ounces and ounces of gold, you know, going through right now.
At the moment, they're spread out along a stretch of the Fresno River that cuts through the 80 acres. Riggs is having some luck.
That's a piece of gold.
That little speck?
That little speck. I've had three pans and I've found three or four pieces of gold.
Yeah. Riggs has been gold prospecting since he was six and now he's 69. He's the claim director for the 900-member Central Valley Prospectors Club. They meet monthly, have several claims across the state, and host educational events at schools. Riggs says the group is the largest nonprofit club like it in the U.S., and this year, he says, gold prospectors are out in force. The reason? All the runoff from the Sierra Nevada is creating perfect conditions to find gold. Mark White is the president of the club.
You can feel the boulders hitting the ground within the river through your feet. That's how much water power is coming down. So anytime you have that hydro movement, you have gold movement. You have things breaking loose.
He says after wet years, prospectors often find a lot of gold. The crew hasn't found large nuggets of gold yet this season, but Larry Riggs' wife, Kathy, has found a lot of flakes. She says every flake is worth it because gold is worth around $1,200 an ounce. She says there's a couple hundred women in the club, and often they're better at gold prospecting than men.
I don't know if it's because we like jewelry or what, but there's a good sense of where it is. And we used to have races to see who would find the most gold. And usually I would win. Because he goes by science and I go by feel.
To pan for gold, Kathy Riggs is using a green plastic pan about 10 inches wide with three ridges on one side. On top of it, she sits a metal net where she sifts wet dirt from the rocks. She's digging where the water's calm near the edge of the river.
And you always look at this because you may have what's called a picker, and that would be a piece of gold big enough to stay in the classifier and not drop into the pan.
After she gets through the rocky top layer, she slowly shakes it underwater to get rid of all the fine layers of dirt and rocks. What she's eventually left with is black sand and little flecks of gold. Instead of sifting through the sand for gold, Kathy takes it home and sorts it out there.
So what you're looking for is to separate the black sand and hopefully find a little bit of gold. There was one little tiny itty-bitty piece in there.
When the river dies down later this summer, the Riggs say prospectors will search in the center of the river for gold. Larry Riggs says often that's where the nuggets are, but at the moment with the high floodwaters, that'd be very dangerous and isn't advised.
What I would do is get right in here where it's behind the rock.
This area?
Yep.
As the crew is teaching me how to pan for gold, the club's director warns me about something. I might get gold fever. That's where people do crazy things for gold. Mark White says people have murdered each other over the precious metal, and not just during the gold rush era.
It can get real ugly real fast the bigger the gold, and nowadays it's a little bit better. Back in the old days, they just drop you and take it. You don't want to be bragging too much or strutting around too much, but you do want to come out and enjoy yourself.
And when I finally get the hang of it and get rid of all the rocks and extra dirt out of my pan, I spot two tiny flecks of gold.
Now you're getting it. That's the easiest way to do it.
And Riggs, the old-timer, asked me a question.
How did you feel when you first saw it?
I had a little rush.
You betcha.
When you walked away, I was like, I have gold fever.
Riggs swears that I'm now addicted, and he might just be right. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The GOP-backed health care bill that's currently in the House is one of the biggest topics of national debate. But what would the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act mean for people here in the San Joaquin Valley? That is the topic of an event Valley Public Radio is hosting Thursday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. at our new broadcast center in Clovis. We'll be joined by three local health care leaders, including top executives from community hospitals and Clinica Sierra Vista, to learn how they're reacting to the changing health care landscape. It's part of our new series of public forums we call Be Public Live. You can find more information about how to RSVP for that free event on our website at kvpr.org. As a bit of a preview of that event, over the next few weeks on this program, we're going to hear different perspectives on the law. This week, we'll hear from one of the bill's critics. Next week, one of its supporters. Right now, joining us is Anthony Wright. He is the executive director of the Sacramento-based group Health Access. They are an advocacy group that has supported the expansion of coverage. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in most San Joaquin Valley counties, about half of residents here are eligible for Medi-Cal, California's version of Medicaid. So any changes to that program would have maybe the biggest effect here in the Valley. This idea that Medi-Cal would change to a block grant, what does that exactly mean?
The proposal by the Republican Congress would have massive impacts to our Medi-Cal program, Medicaid nationally, Medi-Cal in California. It's a program that covers a third of the state, but nearly half of the Central Valley, 41% of San Joaquin County, 50% of Fresno County, and they include lots of people, children, seniors, people with disabilities, people who are at or below the poverty level. And this proposal does two things. One is that it removes the Medicaid expansion, which now covers 4 million Californians, and repeals that part of the bill, rolls that back by 2020. And it also puts a per capita cap in place. It basically caps and forces additional cuts into the Medi-Cal program, not just for the expansion population, but for all 14 million Californians in the program into the future. Right now, the Medicaid program, Medi-Cal in California, is a one-to-one match. For every dollar that the state puts in, the federal dollar puts another dollar in. Under a cap, we would no longer be guaranteed that that dollar. We would get a set amount of, per person for providing coverage, and if healthcare costs go up, if we have an aging population, if there's a public health emergency, the risk and the cost of that is now entirely borne by the state, and the federal government would no longer share. It's a fairly radical restructuring of a program that's been in place for 50 years, and it's deeply alarming, not just for those people who have Medi-Cal coverage, but for the sustainability of our healthcare system as a whole.
So this would affect potentially even individuals who were in Medi-Cal before the expansion.
That's right, because it would mean that we no longer are getting that federal guarantee that and that shared responsibility between the state and the federal government. It now means that if there are additional costs that happen because there's the next version of HIV or Zika or public health emergency that increases prices, if there is some other eventuality, a public health emergency, a natural disaster that increases health care costs, that would be borne entirely by the state, which is less equipped to deal with those increases than the federal government is.
Now, they're saying, again, this is the latest proposal right now, but this is the proposal that's on the table. They're saying that the Medi-Cal expansion or Medicaid expansion would be rolled back completely by 2020. Is there a framework on how they would get there? How would they either disenroll people, or I saw this thing that as people term out or as they become off the scale of income qualification, is there some discussion about how that would actually work?
Yes. So people would be able to stay on the Medi-Cal program through 2020 and actually beyond. But if they cycled off of Medi-Cal even for a month and came back on, then they would be at that. They would come back at a much lower match rate, and then it would be up to the state to decide if they would continue the program for those folks at that lower rate. It would be a lot more expensive as a result. The state of California gets $17 billion to be able to provide coverage to that Medicaid expansion population. We could potentially make up some of that, but if we don't have the matching dollars, we could potentially lose all of that $17 billion. And just to give you a sense of scale about how big that number is, that is more than what the state of California spends on all of higher education combined, the UCs, the CSUs, the community colleges. So it's not something that the state could easily backfill with our existing tax structure and dollars.
Would covered California continue under the plan even if the federal exchange goes away?
The proposal is a little bit unclear about how covered California would proceed. What this proposal does is reduce the subsidies and tax credits that are available under covered California. Right now in California, we have about 1.5 million people who buy coverage through covered California. 90% of them get a tax credit to be able to better afford coverage. On average, that subsidy is $440 a month, which is pretty significant, helps low and moderate income people be able to afford coverage. That amount would be reduced in total and also shifted so that it is no longer tied to either the income of the people getting the break or the price of the premium. It would just be a flat tax credit. And thus, because of that, there's lots of low and moderate income people who would see their insurance costs go up by thousands of dollars, and many of them would drop out of coverage. There's two questions. One is that covered California would likely be smaller, and it may also be that depending on how they structure it, covered California may or may not be able to use its purchasing power to bargain for the best price, as it has done successfully over the past 3 years since the implementation of the law. So some of those are details to be worked out. And again, those are exactly the kind of questions that make it's crazy how quickly they're moving this process without answering some fairly basic questions about this proposal. They've already passed it through two committees without having even basic information about how this would actually work.
There's also some talk, at least that I've heard, that this is presenting an interesting challenge right now as we speak in March of 2017 about the companies that participate in the exchange currently. They have to submit their plans moving forward for the next year. Is this creating uncertainty in that process?
Absolutely. Covered California has had the benefit of having about a dozen plans participate since the beginning, and several options per region throughout the state. But the uncertainty about, since the election, about what will happen has given some of the insurers pause about whether they can participate. You know, they're being asked to continue to enter into a new open enrollment period, which means taking on healthy and sicker people into their insurance pool without the guarantee that there will be a stream of healthy people into the future, either because of the changes in the individual mandate or the changes in the subsidies, which help people afford coverage and sign up for coverage. If they don't have those guarantees, it's an open question whether the insurers will want to take on the risk of taking on another batch of folks, including sick people, if they don't have the guarantee that there's also going to be healthy people coming in, including those who get financial help to be able to afford the coverage.
I think it's pretty well documented that California's rollout of the exchange and other measures under the law was smoother than the experience in other states. And a lot of the criticism that has been levied against the law, the lack of competition in that marketplace and other things, is a little bit different here in California. Is there something that California did specifically better than other states? Why the difference there, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think we had the urgency of wanting to get this done because we actually had one of the highest uninsured rates in the country prior to the Affordable Care Act. So I think that there was just an urgency of having a real problem, and finally we had a federal framework and financing to address the problem. And so I think that's part of it. I think part of it is that we wanted it to work. There was many states who frankly sabotaged the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, not expanding Medicaid, not setting up their own exchange, not doing the marketing and the outreach to get people in. We did all that. And then we took additional steps, not just to implement, but to improve the law. We were the first in the nation to set up an exchange, Covered California, and we gave it the power to bargain for the best possible price and really standardized benefits so that it would be an easier shopping experience. We worked to try to get as many people enrolled in Medi-Cal because we know that it's a lot more efficient and effective to have people get primary and preventative care in the front end rather than more expensive emergency room care in the back end.
One of the things we want to touch upon in this event coming up at Valley Public Radio on March 23rd is, again, what happens if the law goes away? What happens if the expansion of coverage goes away and you have many people who previously didn't have health insurance or weren't eligible for Medi-Cal back prior to 2009? And in Fresno County, many of those people were on a county indigent health care plan. That went away with the expansion of coverage. It also left a number of undocumented residents out of health care. It was a big fight over that program. And the county said, well, you know, our state funding that we used to get to take care of these people is gone, so we can no longer offer it in the future. Is there planning in Sacramento right now of, okay, if the law is changed on the federal level, are counties and hospitals that receive a higher proportion of people who either are sicker or don't have insurance, is the funding mechanism, are those plans in place to try to replicate the system that we had before, or are we going to go to something completely different?
Well, you know, the system we had before was wholly inadequate to the job of providing care to the uninsured. That's why it was such a crisis. That's why we had people who, because they were uninsured, lived sicker, died younger, were one emergency away from financial ruin. There was a threadbare county safety net that tried valiantly in different areas to assist, but it was a patchwork, but it was a poor patchwork. I think there's a number of folks at the state level who are trying to figure out what we would do in the eventuality of a repeal, as well as these additional cuts and caps to Medi-Cal. But the numbers are so staggering that if it is something like this proposal in the House right now, it's hard to see how we backfill it. Just to give you some comparison, California voters voted for a tobacco tax last fall to raise the tobacco tax by $2. It was a hard-fought effort. It was actually the third time we went to the ballot to raise money for to invest in Medi-Cal, and that raised about $1 billion for Medi-Cal. So just the money for the Medi-Cal expansion alone, or for the $17 billion, we would need to do the equivalent of 17 tobacco taxes to backfill the money that we would lose just on the Medi-Cal expansion. That doesn't include the extra $5 billion that Californians get to help afford coverage through Covered California. So these are fairly major numbers, and you know, depending on what happens, you know, whether if it ends in gridlock and nothing happens, or if there's a complete repeal and additional cuts, you know, that's a difference of tens of billions of dollars that it's hard to plan for when the differences are just that great.
Does this repeal effort change other things that are in the Affordable Care Act that aren't necessarily about the expansion of coverage? But, you know, it promoted teaching health centers. It promoted a change from fee-for-service in the hospital environment, where hospitals are paid for doing things, to pay for performance, where hospitals are paid when they achieve a goal. Are those things also being changed?
Yes and no. There are a variety of things, including a number of important consumer protections, like no lifetime limits on plans, that cannot be changed through the budget reconciliation process that the House and Senate are attempting to use to make these changes. The reason they're using this special process is because it only requires 51 votes in the Senate rather than 60. And they can't get 60 due to Democratic opposition. So they are leaving in place some of the consumer protections in place. And we in California would have also tried to put many of the federal consumer protections that were put in place at the federal level also in state statute. However, especially what they can change in this budget reconciliation process is things regarding money. And so something that would be cut in addition is investments in prevention and public health. This would actually be a fairly massive cut of hundreds of millions of dollars to the Centers for Disease Control for things like vaccinations. And it's stunning that there's a bill that's about improving health that's cutting fairly basic and important prevention and public health type investments. The other piece of the bill that is, because it's about money, is that it's a fairly major tax cut for the wealthiest in our society, as well as for the health industry, the insurers, the drug companies, etc. And you know, that's, and so at some level, this is basically a transfer of public dollars from low and moderate income people to afford health care for major tax breaks for the health industry and for the wealthiest.
Before we go with Anthony Wright today of Health Access California, do we have data yet on how effective the law was or has been in improving health? Do we know if we have better health outcomes today than we did in 2009?
We are starting to see that. The law has been in place for a couple of years now, and so we're just starting to get the data that is fairly positive, both on the side of financial security. People, we are seeing reductions in medical bankruptcies. We are seeing reductions in medical debt. And there was more work that we needed to do to improve, to reduce deductibles, provide greater affordability. California was taking some additional steps in that regard. This proposal would actually encourage higher deductibles as part of its design. With regard to actual health, there are starting to see some data that suggests that people are having much better access to primary and preventative care, and that it is having an impact both on the mental health as well as physical health side.
Again, Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Health Access California, a group that is critical of this new effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Next week, we'll hear analysis from the other side of the issue. And then on Thursday, the 23rd, March 23rd, at our broadcast center in Clovis, we will hear from people immediately involved in the situation in our new series, Be Public Live, a public event held at the Barman Cheney Performance Studio, featuring top executives from community hospitals, Clinica Sierra Vista, and more, to learn how they are reacting to the changing healthcare landscape. You can RSVP for that free event on our website at kvpr.org, and we do encourage you to RSVP as seating is very limited. It will not be broadcast live on the air, but will be streamed on our website. Anthony Wright of Health Access, thanks for joining us today, talking about these big changes that are potentially in the works for healthcare here in the Valley.
Thank you so much.
And stay with us in the next half of our show. Assemblymember Rudy Salas joins us to talk about his new legislation about Valley fever. And we also talked to the filmmaker behind a new documentary on National Geographic. She just happens to be from Fresno. And the film just happens to be about California's new water wars. That's all coming up straight ahead here on Valley Edition. Fresno is one of the largest communities in the Valley that doesn't have a dedicated senior center. That's something that current city council member and state assembly candidate Clint Olivier wants to change. He's penned an op-ed in the Fresno Bee calling for just that, and he joins us now on Valley Edition. Clint, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So why a senior center and why now?
Well, I think that there have been some events at what kind of masquerades as a senior center at Manchester Center, the old mall at Shields and Blackstone. Fresno Unified offers adult classes there with a discounted rate for seniors. And this has been a point where they congregate. There used to be a lounge available there offered to seniors, and it's been closed. So my office has received a number of phone calls from seniors who are looking for a place to go. So I've got 2 years left. I think that it's worth having a community-wide conversation. They've got senior centers in Orange Cove. They've got them, in surrounding communities. Bakersfield has two. Long Beach has six. Sacramento offers one. Fresno doesn't offer anything for senior citizens. And so I thought, let's get together and have a community-wide conversation that involves the city, nonprofits, the church, and see if there's a way forward here so Fresno can do right by its seniors.
A lot of parks and recreation programmer-type programs were cut pretty severely during the last 8 years of budget crunches at City Hall. Some of that is starting to come back. Given with that in mind and the fact that there always might be another downturn coming, is this something the city should take on alone, by itself, or partner up with somebody else? Because it seems like in the past it's been hard for the city to sustain those sorts of operations.
Right. And that's a great question. And that's one that we're definitely going to be taking a look at when we form our task force. Hey, let's put it this way, $500 million behind in deferred maintenance. That includes $250 million for our streets and roads in the city of Fresno, which we all know the condition of those. We're going to have to pay about $25 million for the stadium in deferred maintenance. We owe $10 to $12 million in deferred maintenance on the convention center alone. So basically, you're right. The city of Fresno is facing a bubble, and this is a deferred maintenance bubble. And these bills are coming due as our infrastructure continues to deteriorate right before our very eyes. Now add to that, the Police Officers Association, the police union. They're working with the city in terms of retaining officers, and I'm going to ballpark it here. We hired 200 last year, but 125, 150 left. So we're trying to, we just elected a mayor whose goal is to have 1,000 police officers on the street, but we can't retain them. So yes, it's about priorities. We've got the deferred maintenance bubble. We've got, of course, public safety salaries. That they of course took pay cuts and deferrals during the Great Recession. They want to come back too. So we're talking about priorities, and I would hope that working in conjunction with the private sector and other nonprofits and maybe the county, maybe others, to sit down at the table and find out where do seniors fit in terms of prioritizing. We're talking about thousands of baby boomers retiring every day in this country. And of course, we have a large population of baby boomers who are going to be retiring here in Fresno. So, at least in my district and other parts of the city, you know, people think of retirees, oh, let's go on a Viking river cruise, you know, in Europe, let's do this, let's do that. In my district, my retirees can't afford to do that. So what are we going to do as a community? You know, in Orange Cove, they go to the senior center. In Sacramento, they go to the senior center. What do they do in Fresno? Nothing right now. Hopefully we can fix that, but as a community.
Before we go, two big issues before the city council coming up in the coming days. There's right now a proposal by Mayor Brand to establish this public safety advisory board he talked about during the campaign, and also combined with the restructuring of the police auditor. He hopes it'll build community trust in the department. Where do you stand right now on that proposal that goes before you and your colleagues Thursday?
I'm going to vote for it. I think that, you know, love him or hate him, I think Mayor Brand is really doing a good job in his first 100 days here. He's tackling a lot of things, getting them off his plate. And this is another campaign promise that he made to bring our community together. And so I think it's a great idea. Let's have some citizens get together and talk about some of the issues facing policing. And I think that when it comes forward, I'm going to be a supporter because it's the right thing to do. Let's talk. I mean, it's you can never underestimate the importance of getting folks around a table and talking, and especially surrounding an issue of police accountability and police tactics. I think it will be a net win for our community, for our city.
Fresno City Council member and a current State Assembly candidate Clint Olivier joining us today to talk about Senior Center in Fresno and his plan for that, and also this plan by Mayor Brand for a Public Safety Advisory Board. Clint, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for thinking of me today.
You're listening to Valley Edition. There's new legislation in Sacramento dealing with a problem that is especially well known in the San Joaquin Valley, Valley Fever. Assemblymember Rudy Salas from Bakersfield recently introduced legislation to improve the way the state tracks Valley Fever cases and to bring more funding to the disease. It was inspired in part by a reporting series from the Center for Health Journalism known as Just One Breath, of which Valley Public Radio, the Bakersfield Californian, and other outlets are all participants. Assemblymember Salas joins us now. Rudy, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
So you've introduced legislation now that tackles two different issues on Valley Fever. Let's first take up the funding thing, because this has been something that's lingering for a long time. You're hoping to get more money to do what for Valley Fever? Are we looking at a cure? Are we looking at testing, awareness? What exactly is the problem you're trying to solve?
Absolutely. No, I mean, and thank you for the question, and thank you for having me on. We know Valley Fever is obviously a problem, not just in the Valley, but it actually affects almost every county in the state of California. Some of the funding that we have identified in Assembly Bill 1279 is funding that will help hopefully create a statewide database. One of the things we've found is when we've been doing our research is that there's so much inaccuracy, there's so many numbers that don't correlate between the locals, the state, and the feds. And so what we wanted to do is do twofold. One, make sure that we have uniform reporting, and secondly, put some resources towards actually tackling Valley Fever. Now, if that funding goes towards streamlining the entire process for identification and education, you know, that's one discussion that we're having. But the second one, too, is also this new vaccine that people are starting to create and get excited about. You know, one of the other things as well with the funding, and maybe this is another funding request that we follow up with through our budget process, is also looking at some of the universities that are starting to look at this and starting to develop centers. And so I've talked to a number of folks that have been not only delving into Valley Fever, but just trying to understand it and see what we could do because so many people are affected.
Again, talking about Valley Fever here today, Harold Pierce from the Californian did a great piece about how the numbers between the state and the county in Kern County, which tracks so many of these cases there, simply don't add up. I know that caught your attention. When you talk to people in Sacramento, do they have any explanation for what the problem is?
It's about how you identify it and when do you identify it along the process. I've talked to a number of folks and they've been saying, well, we've identified it if it's a new case. Other folks are identifying it when it's an existing case, and yet other folks will identify it only when they see it in the emergency room. And so you have all of these different standards, and that's one of the things we want to tackle, is to show that this is a bigger problem than people, than the numbers are actually showing. And once we've identified even that first initial step, then we can say, look, there's a real issue here, because for everyone that doesn't live in the Valley, right, we know it's an issue, but how do we now start putting the resources towards taking care of folks that are dealing with Valley fever? How are they dealing with the symptoms? How are we making sure that we're, if there's a cure out there, how are we working towards that cure or some type of medicine to help?
So when it comes specifically to funding, what are you asking for? How much?
Right now, we're starting with $2 million, either to create the statewide database system, to have the uniform reporting process, or actually working towards a cure. And that's something that we're debating right now with the budget committee. As you know, the governor came out with his budget in January. It had no funding towards this. We saw that as very deficient and wanted to make sure that we put in a request and legislation that's asking for funding to look specifically at Valley fever research reporting and possibly towards a cure. So we're in the middle of that process right now. We'll be going through that up through May when we do our infamous May revise and then present a balanced budget back to the governor on June 15th.
Every few years, it seems that Valley fever gets a champion in Sacramento, but sometimes it goes by the wayside. Michael Rubio a few years ago was a big backer of trying to do something on this issue, and then he left office, and it kind of fell off the radar. Do you hope this is something that you can carry through, not just with this legislation, but keeping the profile of Valley fever on maybe other issues as well, other legislation in the future?
Yeah, no, we're definitely moving forward with this and want to keep it on the radar every single year, especially as more and more people are being affected. In fact, I've already enlisted the help of some of my Valley colleagues with this, and I testified actually in a committee hearing with Assemblymember Rambola talking about the needed funding for Valley fever. And so, you know, definitely not only just putting it on the radar, but trying to move the ball forward. And like I said, boy, having consistent research and reporting and working towards a possible cure, I think that's where we need to be headed, especially as more and more families every single year are being more affected by Valley fever.
Bakersfield Assemblymember Rudy Salas joining us today on Valley Edition. Assemblymember Salas, thanks so much.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to participate.
You're listening to Valley Edition. There's a new documentary out all about water in California and the sometimes shady backroom deals that come with it. The National Geographic film is called Water and Power, a California Heist. It airs tonight. It features familiar Valley voices like journalist Mark Arax and Bakersfield, Californian columnist Lois Henry. The film's director, Marina Zenovich, also grew up in Fresno. To tell us more about the film, FM 89's Ezra David Romero spoke with Zenovich, as well as Adam Keats. He's the senior attorney at the Center for Food Safety in San Francisco and is featured in the film.
Thanks for joining us.
Of course. I'm from Fresno.
Yeah, that was actually my first question. Tell me about your Fresno history.
I was born and raised in Fresno, went to Bullard High. It was a wonderful place to grow up. The courthouse there is named after my dad. My dad was an assemblyman, senator, and then a judge in Fresno, and the Central Valley was his district. And my mom was from the former Yugoslavia, and so we traveled a lot. So I got a sense of the outside world, and so I moved, went to college in Los Angeles, and then moved to New York for a while, and I'm now in Los Angeles, based in LA. So, but I have fond memories of Fresno. I love coming back. Part of the reason I did this film was to spend as much time as I could in the Central Valley and working with Mark Arax, who I had never met before this project, but I knew of his work and was a fan of his writing. I went to high school with his little brother, it was a lot of fun to be able to come back and, you know, include my mom and what I was doing and what have you.
Tell me a little bit about the film. What intrigued you to create it?
I was interested in exploring backroom deals and the politics of water, as well as learning about the history of the State Water Project. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't know a lot about the State Water Project.
I watched the film last night, and I was surprised, even as an environmental reporter, about the depth of the shady deals that were going on, or in some cases are still happening. How did you go about understanding some of these things?
I'm pretty literal, so I always assume that people are telling me the truth. But it was fascinating to kind of hear all the different sides and how the Monterey Amendments are viewed differently by different people, depending on kind of where they sat with regards to that series of meetings and decisions. So, you know, I was lucky enough to have a lot of researchers. We just interviewed people and tried to piece together the story as best we could, kind of what our research and experts kind of told us.
How did growing up in California sort of shape this film for you?
Well, I care about this state on a deep level, as I assume any Californian does. You know, my father passed away a few years ago, so in a way it was kind of going back into his world, if you will.
I know you'll have to run off to go to set in a moment, and then we'll bring in Adam Keats, but what do you want people to take away from the documentary?
You know, this is a very serious issue. We show people in the film whose wells are going dry. You know, one of our characters says, watch out, you know, you could be next. You could be next. People need to realize that this is serious and we don't manufacture water and it's not a limitless resource. So we need to pay attention to what is happening and conserve as well as make sure that our public resource isn't going into the hands of private companies.
That was the film's director, Marina Zenovich, who grew up here in Fresno. To tell us more about the film, we're joined by Adam Keats. He's the senior attorney at the Center for Food Safety in San Francisco and is featured in the film. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Thank you, Ezra. Great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the film. What should people expect?
Although it's a dense subject, it's done very well. It's a little bit of a thriller.
So how'd you get involved in this?
I've been an environmental lawyer for a long time. I've been doing this for about nearly 20 years. I was mostly doing land use law, and I was looking at a project down in Southern California in the Tehachapi Mountains on the Tejon Ranch project. Tejon Ranch property, and they had I looked at their environmental review, and they had this water supply was coming from this thing called the Kern Water Bank, and I knew nothing about the Kern Water Bank. I'd never heard of it before, and I'd never really litigated or gotten involved in water supply issues before that. So I started asking around, and it was like scratching a little bit of a scab, and I scratched it off, and all of a sudden, you know, this has now been 8-9 years later, I'm spending all my time litigating water law, and specifically most of my time on the Kern Water Bank. I did never imagine this would happen.
Yeah, you know, I cover agriculture and the environment for the station, and, you know, after watching this video, it sort of made me question, like, the way the valley works and the way water works. Is that sort of the intent of this film, is to get people's minds working?
Well, it's definitely my intent in the work that I'm doing, and I'm glad that the filmmakers caught on to that. I mean, it's always a risk when you know, I don't know if they're going to get it or not. It's hard. It's kind of hard to grab it, and they definitely understood where I was going and what we were doing here at my organization, Center for Food Safety, what we're trying to do with kind of ringing this alarm bell. And, I mean, specifically, you know, we have this long history of economics related to food production. Obviously, it's part of commerce, and food is a commodity, and it's sold and bought and traded and stuff. But we've separated water from that. Water has been kind of sacred. It's been very sacred in this country for a long time. It's sort of, we don't think of it in the same way we think of cattle or, you know, tomatoes or something. And I think that what's happening is, what this film is showing is that people are starting to try to pull water into that relationship. And I think what the film is saying is, and what we've been saying is, look, if you do that, if you make water into something that's just an item to be traded, just like anything else, there are going to be haves and have-nots. And when you have have-nots with water, it's very different than when you have have-nots with tomatoes. I mean, you can't live without water. No one can. Nothing can. And I think we need to be taking a much more serious look at having finance control how we distribute our water in the state.
Yeah, I was super intrigued by all the backdoor meetings mentioned in the documentary, you know, about shady water deals, profiting a very small few. You know, you talk about the Monterey Amendments quite a bit in the documentary. Can you give me a quick idea of what those are?
Very broad scope. I mean, what the Monterey Amendments were, a deal made by Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, which is mainly the urban users in Southern California, and the Kern County Water Agency, which is mainly the agricultural users in the southern San Joaquin Valley. And they basically got together and said, look, we've been fighting each other. What would it take to stop fighting each other about the state water project, about the water we're both getting from the north? And what the solution was to strip the state water project of its checks and balances and its controls that before that required it to be operated on a sustainable and equitable way. So for those of us that weren't part of that conversation, that weren't either Met or Kern County Water Agency or the other couple of users that were in that deal, so let's say Delta farmers, let's say salmon fishermen, let's say Native Americans, Northern California Native Americans that are dependent on fish and water, let's just say all the fish in the environment in the Delta, none of those interests were represented in that deal. And so you talk to those folks, and the movie quotes them. They say, yeah, this is a great deal. We really worked hard at this. We saw this giant civil war we were having. Well, I mean, the civil war was just between two parties that actually had pretty common interests. The rest of the state got cut out of the deal. And what we've been doing at Center for Food Safety since then, we've been fighting to get those excluded voices back into the equation.
It was interesting to watch this documentary because I saw people that I've interviewed. It was sort of close to home for me. We talked about all the stuff that's going on, but what do you think's next for water in California? Are there shady deals happening today?
There is a movement in California to privatize our water resources, and it's through this concept of water trading and water transfers. There are bills being talked about and proposed and submitted that seek to facilitate the ability of different water users to be able to trade their water with each other, to create like an Australian-style water marketplace where water is bought and sold on a common marketplace. I think that is something that this film suggests is probably not the road that we want to be going down. So I would say that there's going to be a battle in California over water trading and water marketplace, and that's the general concept of water privatization. At the same time, there's this law, SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, that got passed a couple years ago that is slowly, unfortunately, probably too slowly, but still is slowly putting in restrictions on the use of groundwater. And so I think there will be incorporation of our groundwater resources into kind of the discussion that we have about sustainability in the state. And that's going to be a good thing. So we're going to have these kind of counter opposing forces of kind of trying to, you know, release the Krakens with the marketplace and then also recognizing the importance of regulation and kind of saying we still need to be having solid, strong oversight and a government hand in how we distribute these scarce common resources.
What do you want people to take away from this film?
I think the biggest takeaway is that water is a sacred moral human right. We should not allow the marketplace or dollars, money, to have anything to do with it. When we allow that to happen, we're going to be opening the door to consequences that we all should agree are unacceptable, morally unacceptable, environmentally unacceptable. It's not who we are to dewater the Delta and to cause all these species to go extinct. It's not who we are to bankrupt farmers in the Delta just to benefit some corporate farmers in the San Joaquin Valley. And it's not who we are to dewater, you know, villages and towns and people just so we can export almonds to China. I just don't think any of those things are equations that people, if they were able to be involved in them, they would not make those decisions the same way they're trying to be made now.
Yeah, it's a very complex situation going on here in California. Any final thoughts before we go?
I urge folks to watch the movie and then to go in deeper than the movie. The movie obviously just scratches the surface. There's a lot more going on, and you know, my organization, Center for Food Safety, has a lot on our website, and there are a lot of other groups that are doing good work on this also that people should check out.
I've been chatting with Adam Keats. He's a senior attorney with the Center for Food Safety in San Francisco, and he's featured in the new documentary Water and Power, A California Heist, which airs tonight on National Geographic. Thanks for joining me, Adam.
Thank you, Ezra. Appreciate it.
And this is Valley Edition for our producer and reporter, Ezra David Romero, our audio engineer, Marv Allen, production and operations manager, Don Weaver, and reporters Jeffrey Hess and Kerry Klein. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.